welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Turn the Page. I'm your host today, Jen, and I'm here with a supremely talented writer who I am so excited to talk to, who is here with an absolutely beautiful book. May I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Well, thanks for having me. I'm Susan Meisner, and the book we're talking about today is called Only the Beautiful. It's been out for just a few days, actually, and it's a book set against the backdrop of the eugenics movement in the early 20th century.
It is, it's so beautiful and so moving, and it like deals with a lot of very complex issues in a very, I think, sensitive yet direct way, which I think is really hard to do. But before we get there, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, your career and your journey toward this book, because you've worked a lot in historical fiction, especially about women, and I think with complex relationships about women. So could you talk a little bit about how maybe your writing interests led you to this story?
Sure. Well, I started writing about 20 years ago, and it was contemporary fiction, and I always had a female heroine protagonist. So that's been my jam, I guess you could say, is I like writing about strong female characters, or characters who don't know they're strong until they're put to the test, and then they realize they are far stronger than they believe. And then in 2008, I wrote my first historical fiction contemporary dovetail. So it was two dual timelines. And the more I wrote those types of books that had a historical thread running through it, the more I realized what I really love is historical fiction. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of switched it up after 2008 and started to concentrate mostly on women in the past. And they're not always, in fact, they've never actually been real historical figures in history. I like to kind of have complete creative control. So my female characters are fictional, but they're always in the real world of our past. And I like to imagine stories of ordinary people facing extraordinary circumstances. And a lot of times those circumstances are global. Those are the types of stories that lend themselves to the type of page turners that people like, because trouble creates tension, and tension creates an interesting book. So my female characters are almost always involved in some kind of either a disaster or a war or something that's life altering. And I think it's because we like to imagine those things, but not actually experience them. But we kind of want to know, what would I do if I was faced with that circumstance? And you can do that with fiction, because you don't actually have to go through the event to feel like you've been there.
That's super interesting. And it does, I think, link up with, so back in February, our library had a discussion about one of your books, The Nature of Fragile Things. And that was about, is it the 1906? Is that the year, the earthquake in San Francisco? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, exactly what you were just talking about, like women in difficult situations. And I think who, you know, kind of find their strength, like through not only themselves, but like through their connections with other women too. I love how that all links up to something that I saw on your website, where it says that you write stories of where we've been and where we're going. And I think it's kind of cool that, you know, you've explored both the past and the present in your writing. And have you found that like exploring both in your writing has affected the way that you think about, let's say, like, you know, the links between past and present, you know, like how the past affects what we do now and how what we do now is informed by things that have happened? Like, is that something that you found you've evolved on a little bit through writing? Or
I absolutely believe that the past informs us. We make our decisions today based on our experiences of the past. And sometimes it's a past that's only ours. But a lot of times the past is the past that everyone experienced. Like, I think when we move on from COVID, we're changed. We've been through something. It was big. It changed a lot of things for a lot of people. And I think we're coming around the outside of it now. I think it's in the rear view. I hope it is. And I think in the years to come, we're going to realize how that event changed us, which means we take it with us into our future because it's part of our past. And some parts of our past are easily shrugged off and some of them tend to last. I think this is one of those things that's going to last. It's like my grandparents who had to live through the Depression. They were never able to throw anything away ever. Even years later, when my grandfather was very wealthy, it was just part of the fabric of his past. And so for him, it didn't matter that he had money. What mattered is he went through something very difficult where you didn't have anything and you wondered, where are we going to get our next meal? That's why I think the past matters to us, because it's created us. It's who we are. And looking back at the past through the vehicle of story allows us to see where we've been. And when we can see where we've been, it does give us a lens for seeing where we're going.
That is all so interesting. And I'd love to talk about like how that's at work in this book, in Only the Beautiful. You have two different stories going on that are separated by a fairly short time difference. One is in California, 1938, and one is in Austria in 47. I think it starts there anyway. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about our two protagonists of the two dual timelines, because they share a lot of interesting connections and interests and sort of vulnerabilities, but they are also very different. So can you talk about them and sort of their relationship?
Sure. Well, the two characters in this novel, the main characters, one is named Roseanne. She goes by Rosie for most of the book. And we meet her when she's 17. She's young, obviously. She's also an orphan. She lives on a California vineyard where she works and lives. And her parents also lived on the vineyard before they died in an accident. That's not a spoiler. You're going to learn that from the get-go. And she was allowed to remain on the vineyard and work there because, you know, they died when she was still a minor. We also find out at the very beginning that she's unmarried and pregnant. She also has a sensory anomaly called synesthesia, which only 1% of the population has. And what it is, it's a tangling of the senses in a person's mind. And not a bad way, it's just very different. So a synesthete might hear a doorbell and see yellow diamonds in their mind, or they might hear a rooster crow and see blue spheres. And so what it is for them is auditory stimulus creates a visionary response, and that's different. For her, though, that's going to put a target on her back, because she's in the height of what we call the eugenics movement, and that was a movement to control the collective gene pool, and anything that was seen as divergent was seen as a disability and inferior. And a lot of eugenic leaders wanted to weed out hereditary traits that somehow degraded the gene pool, and differences like this would have caught their eye. And so she's the one character. The second one is Helen. She is also in a way related to the vineyard. Her sister-in-law owns the vineyard where Rosie lives and works. And Helen is an expat. She has been a nanny in Europe for 3 decades. It's a life that she loves. And she's in her late 50s, early 60s. So she's been there for pretty much all of her working life, and never married, never had children of her own, but she learned to love the children that she cared for. And when we meet her, she's taking care of a disabled child in Nazi-occupied Vienna. She has been to see her brother in the past. So she's met Rosie on 2 different occasions. She knows her. She kind of adopted a maternal-like affection for Rosie. And when she sees, when Helen sees eugenic thinking at its absolute worst in World War II, she's going to come home for good in 1947, a changed person. And she's going to find out what happened to Rosie in those years she was away, and she's going to want to move heaven and earth to find her. I won't tell you more than that because I don't want to spoil anything for anybody.
Yeah, it is such a thoughtfully told exploration of the eugenics movement and two very different manifestations of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the most important things that the book does is, you know, when we think about World War II, we tend to think of that as like our least morally complex war, you know, like it's very clear who the good guys were and it's very clear who the bad guys were. And this book, like, really, I think, blurs our image of ourselves as like good guys, perhaps, you know, because like something similar was happening at home. It was just happening in a kind of like softer, mm-hmm. more polite, maybe, let's say, way, you know. And so I would love to if you could talk about like the sources that you used in order to investigate, like how it was operating both at home and abroad, like what sources did you use? And for you, like, where do the sources then end at imagination pickup? You know, if that makes sense as a question.
Sure. Yeah, no, those are great questions, actually. There's a definitive work on the eugenics movement by Alexandra Minna Stern, and you can probably get her book at the library or maybe on an interlibrary loan. It's a very good book. If this interests you at all, she's the go-to person on this topic. And the eugenic movement kind of began in the 1910s. It began as what they saw as a very positive thing. It was to create healthy, happy, more robust children, so that we could cut down on societal problems like poverty, which was linked to heredity, and criminality, which was also linked to heredity, and a host of other undesirable traits, all linked to genetics, which, by the way, is not true. Poverty is not linked to heredity, but that's the way they thought about it back then. And so this idea to make for happier, healthier children in itself wasn't a bad idea. It's not a bad idea to try and decrease the number of birth defects that we have. That's not the bad idea. The bad idea was the shift in thinking that anybody born with a defect or born with a deformity or born with a challenge or born with maybe some mental capabilities that are less than what you have, that those people are inferior. And therefore, their genetics need to disappear. That was the terrible thing about this. And added to that, if that's not bad enough, it was widening the scope of what wasn't wanted.
Mm.
So that's when you saw eugenic thinking and how it's a slippery slope, not to make fun of a pun, but you know, you don't need to look any farther than Adolf Hitler to see where that kind of thinking can take a person, can take a great many people, if left untethered. And so that was the book that kind of introduced me to this whole idea that if you boil it down to it, eugenic thinking is just thinking that some people are better humans than others. Mm-hmm. And those that aren't just like these better humans are inferior and their genetics need to go away. Mm-hmm. And that to me was the scariest part of it. So that's all true. That was the truth behind this story. What was fictional, what came out of my imagination was, well, who am I going to create to put into this very volatile crucible of a backdrop? And I struggled with the characters in this book. I didn't have the right ones at the beginning. And I think choosing the characters, since I choose my event first, and then I go like looking for who am I going to put into the story. Sometimes I don't start with the right people. It took me a little while to land on Rosie and Helen. But once I did, and I started giving them personality and problems, because a character needs both, the story started to gel.
Mm, that is super interesting. I would love to know, how do you know when you've landed on the right character? Is it that they provide a particular point of view on the event, or is it something in their, like, I guess, perspective? Like, how do you go about that?
Mm-hmm. I think part of it is dialing it back to the basics. Sometimes I think I make things more complicated for myself because my desire is to make each book better than the last one before it. And I think I still need to start with the basics. And that is, what does the character want? Why don't they have it? And what will happen if they fail? Because that's really the heart of any story. Even Green Eggs and Ham is that. It's a character wants something, they don't have it. What will happen if they fail? It's pretty simple. With Green Eggs and Ham, with most of our novels for, you know, like adults, we want something a little more meatier. And so you look at any novel that you've loved and it's about a character who wants something, they don't have it, they go after it against obstacles. And there's something at stake. If they fail, something's going to happen. And I need to dial back to that with every book. And I think what happened is when I first started, I had a couple of characters that what they wanted didn't come up against the eugenic movement with enough gravitas. You know, it had to matter and they had to be up against huge obstacles for there to be tension in the story. And that's really kind of just basic storytelling, but you have to dial into it and you've got to find the right character for that moment. Rosie would not have been the character for maybe one of my other books, but she was for this one.
I like that. So do you feel like, you know, it's like a sort of, I guess, resonance between the internal stakes for the person and like the stakes that the world or the historical moment provides a little bit?
I definitely think that's the case. I think it's a marriage, really. The story is a marriage of the real world and my fictional characters, and that they matter to each other. Like, they're ingrained. Their wants and desires are ingrained because the eugenic thinkers wanted something too. If you want to think of them as the antagonist, you can. Well, they wanted something too. And what they wanted was diametrically opposed to what Rosie wanted. And that usually makes for a great story.
Wow. So yeah, I you know, talking around certain things so that we don't spoil things for readers is very important to me. But I love, you know, I when I was in grad school before I came to libraries, I did a lot of medical history. And one of the things that I found most fascinating, you know, is that like, we tend to think of medicine as science and science as like universal or, you know, something that has like fixed meanings. But I think like something that's very well illustrated in this book is that like, it's very socially and kind of culturally constructed too. And synesthesia is a great, I think, let's say like phenomenon in order to explore that, you know, because it was once constructed as a disability or as a liability. And I think nowadays it's kind of considered like a gift, you know, like a cool and interesting way of experiencing the world, you know? And so, yeah, like, how do you think, you know, your research into, I guess, like medical institutions and how that kind of shapes people's personal biases, because both are kind of at work here. You know, how do you approach that, like in your research and then on putting it in the on the page?
Right. It's delicate. This one was especially so. And I chose synesthesia because I wanted there to be something in the book that was different and new. And I thought people would learn something. And you're absolutely right. It was seen as an aberration, if you will, back then. And it's not now. Most people that I interviewed, in fact, all of them that I interviewed that are synesthetes, none of them wished they didn't have it. All of them experience only beauty. And sometimes the world can be a little chaotic because there's a lot of auditory stimuli in our world. And it can be a little much. They all told me they've kind of learned to balance it and kind of control it a little bit because they're always going to have a visionary response to auditory stimulus. But everyone told me how beautiful it is. So none of them thought of it as a handicap at all or a disability, but it wasn't understood in the late 20s, early 30s. And so that's why it was seen as something that was a hereditary challenge and should not be passed on. And it is considered hereditary. And then the other part of your question, I think, was the intersection, I guess, of science and philosophy and how we look at things. And I think we do tend to evolve, I think, in what we consider to be, I guess, a scientific truth that's always true. Like, you know, the heart always beats and the heart always needs, you know, the brain always needs oxygen. Those are things that don't shift. But I think we are understanding that there are ways to handle the complexities of being human. There are good ways and then there are poor ways. And I understand completely that it was very expensive to institutionalize somebody who, if they were out on their own and were multiplying and having children, they would create a tremendous strain on society. I get that. So what we needed to do instead was something else. This wasn't the answer, to sterilize people and then send them out to live their impoverished lives, but unable to reproduce. That solved the problem of them being a burden on society in that respect, but it did not solve the problem. It was just, it was a way of solving a part of it. It was not the way. There are better ways. And yes, it's hard to find those better ways to deal with these complex problems, but we're talking about human life. And so it matters. And we need to go to the mat to find those hard answers. You know, hard challenges create a quest for an answer that's probably a hard quest, but it's worth it when we're talking about human life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it kind of shows, I think, that like, medicine or like these institutions, I think, are like let's see, not necessarily like inherently, in, you know, always going to do the right thing all the time. Like they are composed of humans who also make mistakes, you know, and so that like happens on an institutional level, or who have, you know, not the purest motivations. It gets very complex. And I think that, oh gosh, where was I going with that?
I do that all the time too, because if we're talking about something that's very vast and complex, and it a lot of questions arise in our mind. So it's not a difficult, it is a difficult topic to kind of grasp and embrace.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And I think where I was going was that like medicine itself is like, as it's like a technology. And so it is in and of itself kind of neutral, you know? And yeah, there are like, as you said, good ways and bad ways to use it, you know? And yeah, I think like what your story does in a lot of ways is to sort of take that like aloof look and be like, look, these institutions could have had what were like on the surface or even in the hearts of the people doing it, like good motivations, but that didn't have good results or necessarily treat human beings like human beings, you know? And I think that that like even-handedness is very, very important, I think, for understanding. That does bring me to another question I have, which is, so what is it like when you're writing, let's say, like the less sympathetic characters, like the sister-in-law who, you know, Helen revisits? In order to write people like that convincingly, how do you navigate like the sort of like very strong personal feelings that you might have about like the viewpoints that they have or the things that they do?
It's hard. It is hard to write the more difficult characters because you almost have to become them to write them convincingly. And when you start putting on the clothes of somebody like that, you know, it just makes you kind of wince a little bit. But the way I see it is every character that has kind of a rough exterior, they probably didn't start out that way. They weren't born that way. I mean, some people are for sure. But like the sister-in-law, you'll meet her in the book. Her name is Celine. She is kind of prickly. Except that inside you can tell there's like parts of her that want to be compassionate. So it's easy to say she is not a nice person. But then if we could look back, like what if there was a book about Celine, you know, like what made her that way? Like what kind of parenting did she have? How hard was her father on her? And I think it's being able to have a microscope that will allow us to know why Celine does what she does. And this book is not about her. And I'm not going to write one about her, probably. So we can only assume that she is the way she is because probably she was shaped that way. And we don't know if it was nurture or nature. And when I think about it that way, that's how I can inhabit that person, is to think there's probably something that happened to her that shaped her to be this way. And if that's just who she is, then being able to write somebody like that is just using observation, because sadly there are people like her and they're all over the place. There are good people too. And they're all in this book too, but then there are some hard people in the book and she's one of them.
Yeah. I think that is like really key to writing convincing characters, you know, because it does help you understand them better. And, you know, nobody is the villain or the antagonist of their own story, you know, like, so Celine doesn't view herself that way. So you have to kind of put yourself in that shoes, be like, what, like, yeah, like if you saw her as the hero of her own story, what sort of things would she do and say, you know, like that is a super interesting thought experiment. And it creates, you know, very nuanced. And I think characters who, even if you don't, you know, like them, you at least kind of understand how they operate, you know?
Right. Exactly. You know, there's a line in Silence of the Lambs, the movie, where Clarice is talking to, can't remember the guy's name. You know who I mean. I can't remember his name, but he's a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And she's talking to him and he's behind this very secure glass and he's got pictures of Florence behind him. And it's pictures of the Duomo and the streets of Florence. And she's amazed because this man is a cold-blooded killer, but he's having pictures of the Duomo and Florence. And he's telling her, memories are all I have. He's never going to be let out. And it's the only Hannibal Lecter. It's the only moment where you're going to have any kind of sympathy for that man is when you see the pictures of the Duomo and Florence and him saying, memories are all I have. It's like 10 seconds of empathy, but it's there. And then, of course, after that, you don't have a whole lot more for him. But I think every character, there's got to be a kernel of something that makes them continue to still be human.
I mean, it's very interesting to explore, I think. And it's a cool, I think, just narrative technique, you know, because it kind of in a way, like, you know, for me, like when I see that moment, like, and I have that like little instance of empathy or sympathy, you know, for Hannibal Lecter, like mm-hmm. that creates kind of discomfort in yourself and like a little bit of inner, you know, like, and I just think that like it takes people out of their comfort zones and, you know, it makes them question, like how we create monsters of people who, even when they do monstrous things, you know, they're still humans, you know, and we have to understand them.
Right. Exactly. They're not automatons, you know, they're not cyborgs. They're human, even in their most corrupt form. You know, underneath, there's still a beating heart and a mind, and that was somebody's baby. You know, it's like how far back do you need to go to be able to see somebody as human who actually, you know, performs as a monster in their adult life?
Yeah, and it's a necessary thing, I think, for understanding and even progress too, because like when we make monsters of people, like that shuts down understanding, that like encourages us to not understand rather than to learn more. So, you know, I think anything that sort of encourages people to sort of like question things like that is a good thing. And so yeah. I really love how this book does that. And, you know, thank you for writing it and thank you for coming to talk about it with us.
My absolute pleasure. Mm-hmm.
I know this is often a very hard question to answer, but is there anything that you can say about what you're working on or what's on the horizon for you?
Sure. Well, I'm working on a new book that will come out for another 2 years. And so it doesn't have a title yet. And I'm still trying to grab the reins of this story. It still seems like it's out there in the nether and it's waiting for me to capture it. But I can tell you that it's set in the 1950s during the Cold War. You know, the 50s, World War II was over, and it you would think that the 50s would have been a time of great peace and relaxation and a return to normalcy. But the fact was the 1950s were just as scary as World War II, because everyone was afraid of Russia, the USSR, and the Cold War was real, and people were afraid of the bomb. And so I'm just revisiting that whole idea of people not feeling quite at home yet and feeling like home was at risk, because that's what we were afraid of in the 1950s, is that our homeland would be usurped and we would come under the oppression of the USSR. And the other character, because one character deals with that, and the other one is a displaced person, capital D, capital P. She's a DP. She's from Eastern Europe. She's here in the United States. So her home has already been, there is no home for her. She can't go back to where she's from. A lot of Eastern Europeans couldn't go back. A lot of them wouldn't go back, because to go back home after World War II would be to put themselves under Soviet rule. And they didn't want to do that. So you had a million displaced people, and they were in displaced persons camps in Germany and other places. And 200,000 of them came here to the States. And so she's one of them too. So it's the idea of displacement, like what's it like when your home is threatened, or when it feels like it's been taken from you? Where do you find your sense of belonging when home isn't an option anymore? So I don't have a title for it yet, and I'm still writing it. So someday soon it's going to have a title, not yet. But I do have a book coming out in July. It's for children. It's my first children's book, and nothing terrible happens in it. Nothing dark and mentally difficult or emotionally challenging or anything. It's just a children's book called Pumpkin Day at the Zoo. And it's a children's picture book. And it's just about that one day that a lot of zoos have in October when they give their animals pumpkins for their habitats. It's a fun day. So it's a fun book, no dark stuff.
That sounds great. Oh my gosh. Well, I hope that, you know, you'll consider coming back to the show and talking about some of these future projects with us, because it was very nice to talk to you today.
Absolutely. I would love to do that.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming. And thank you to our listeners. You can pick up Only the Beautiful now. It is available. So please, please pick it up at your favorite library or independent bookstore, wherever you get your books. Thank you for joining us. And it is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.